This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Reverend Billy Graham turns 95 on Thursday. Of all of our native sons, Graham could be not only Charlotte's most famous, but most influential. Throughout his career as an evangelist, he met with presidents and popes and influenced both public opinion and public policy. But through it all, he preached to and for the common man. And the common man is the target for Ken Garfield's new book about the man. Ken is the former religion writer for the Charlotte Observer, and his new book, Billy Graham, A Life in Pictures, uses a lot of pictures and a few words to tell the story of his life and legacy. Garfield is also involved with Davidson College's Dr. Ann Wills in a project with Duke University on a book of essays from scholars across the country exploring facets of Billy Graham's life. And Dr. Wills is writing a book about his wife, the late Ruth Bell Graham, while co-editing that volume about Graham himself. And both join us in our Spirit Square studio to tell us what they know about Billy Graham. Welcome. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Welcome back. Good
Thank
to
you.
See you. Given his impact, Billy Graham's impact on the 20th century and both the country, America, and religion in America, along with the presence of the Billy Graham Library and the Billy Graham Evangelical Association, one might wonder if we need any more books about Billy Graham. And yet, can you say that there's a whole generation of up-and-coming young people who don't know him at all?
Absolutely. Over the last year that I've really dug into this project, it's been stunning to me to see the divide between older people, say 30 and up and 30 and below, as far as just not only knowledge of Graham, but certainly appreciation. People under 30 literally do not know who Billy Graham was. His last major crusade was 05 in New York, so that's been 8 years ago. It's been, you know, frail and out of the limelight, and so it's so fascinating to see the people that need to be re-educated about who he was and this amazing legacy and how he changed kind of public religion in America post-World War II.
Why does he need to be? Why do people need to know?
I think there are some really good, relevant lessons, not just for mass evangelism, but for the local church, things like integrity, things like longevity, things like blending entertainment and music and evangelism, faith, keeping to a simple message. I think there are some amazing lessons to learn from how the Graham people and Graham himself did it that can apply to the smallest church, much less mass evangelism.
And you, Dr. Wills, are looking at both Billy Graham and his wife, Ruth, who was probably the most influential clergy wife of the 20th century. Would that be an exaggeration to say?
Wow, it's interesting to think about the influence of clergy wives. That's definitely one of the aspects of her that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. She, and I'm just starting to try to take account of what her influence was on him as a public figure. It's very hard to get to because she didn't like the limelight. And that is typically clergy wives over the centuries of American history have not been expected to take the limelight, but they have been expected to do very specific work and to be a part of their husband's work as clergy. So, most influential clergy wife of the 20th century. I'll have to think about that. Okay. I'll have to think about that.
Let's go back to the beginnings, because if there are so many people who don't know who he is,
right?
Let's go back to the beginnings. And the beginnings, as I understand it, were on a dairy farm near
Correct.
Where the Park Road Shopping Center
Correct.
Is today.
Correct.
That was his father's dairy farm.
Exactly right. In that area, there's a Graham office park near there. My wife has a shop at Park Road Shopping Center. Every once in a while, someone will come in older and reminisce about that and say, I wonder exactly where the Graham house was.
Where was it? Do you know?
Right by Graham office park is my understanding.
And where is that?
That is on the other side of Woodlawn going south towards South Park. On the left as you're going out towards South Park, past Park Road Shopping Center. That was all the Graham farm. His father, Frank Graham, was a large dairy farmer. That obviously all was country back then. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the romance of this story is just so compelling. He grew up on a dairy farm. He milked cows. He loved baseball. He loved girls,
they
say.
He loved girls.
Yeah. A tall, lanky kid who had no faith until he went to a Mordecai Ham tent revival, kind of sat in the back row and kind of slunk down so he wouldn't be seen. And for some reason, he gets up and comes forward and commits his life to Christ. and it was about 1925, 27, and everything changed.
So he was not religious up to that point. What got him to the tent meeting?
His family were, and Ann can help me with this, his family were churchgoers. They went to church. He grew up in a strict Protestant household. But he was a kid. He was a tall, lanky kid who would prefer playing baseball to going to church.
Yeah, I would agree totally with that. That he, the research that I've done, especially on Billy and Ruth's early, when they meet each other, when you look at the college yearbooks and you read about their conversations with one another, it hit me, oh my gosh, they were so young. So he was a kid. He was a teenager who wanted to drive.
How old do we know?
When was the Ham revival?
It would have been about, Graham was born in 18, so about early 30s maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. And as you say, he felt compelled to come forward and accept Christ as his Savior, as they do in these tent meetings.
You know, and I think his biography speaks to his ministry, which is that he would tell you he wasn't a very complicated guy. He was not a deep theologian. He was not a deep thinker. He was from the heart. He made decisions from the heart, theologically and otherwise. And so you ask a great question, why come forward at a revival? It was just, he just did. His biography just talks about it. I was just moved to come forward.
Well, you're a professor of religion. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about Billy Graham and his take on religion, because mm-hmm. he was a tent meeting revivalist among tent meeting revivalists, and somehow his brand soared to the top and overtook everybody else for 50 years or more. What was it about his brand, his take on Christianity, that was so attractive to people? And I don't know how to put this nicely, but does it stand up theologically?
Well, one of the things that we're interested in this co-edited volume that I'm working on with Grant Wacker from Duke University and Andrew Finstuen from Boise State, he's another part of this, is to try to answer that question for college students, like Ken was talking about, who may never have even heard of mm-hmm. Billy Graham. And each of our co-authors, we've got a dozen scholars from all over the country who all work on American religion in terms of doing history, who are trying to spell out and dissect why did he catch on? What made him so big? And so we've got one person is writing about the way that Graham made alliances with local business people to get support and then use that network for outreach. One of our writers is writing about his use of the media, the newspapers, the local radio, or then later television, even feature films, how to use those up-and-coming technologies to reach people who had been, quote-unquote, unreached. Folks who are writing about the way that his preaching worked, the way that his preaching appealed to people and drew them out of their seats, the way that he presented himself as a man, very attractive but unavailable, very appealing and strong but flexible. There's a whole host of reasons that we're trying to explore in this book for why he had what really nobody else had.
But what about his message? Was his message and his approach to you accepting Christ, you as the follower, accepting Christ, was it comparable to other evangelical preachers or other mainline Protestant religious messages, or was there something different about it, more easily accessible about it?
It was definitely more easily accessible, in part because he took himself there with the message. And we were just talking before the show, Ken and I, about this was a free event. This was kind of what would happen. The Crusades were what was happening in a given town over a series of weeks. And so, you know, your friend might be going, your family might be going, your class might be going. So you would go too. And it was free. You didn't have to buy a ticket.
And you have to remember that these things, as you say, went over for several weeks.
Right. Oh, 16.
And people came back night after night.
Right.
How do you fill all of that time in the pulpit with something that's going to make people come back night after night after night, hearing something new or more compelling? Or was he building upon what he did the previous nights? Right. What was he doing that made people want to come back?
He was certainly preaching a different message every night. He had different. He usually had a mass choir from that town that would obviously sing different hymns every night. But at the same time, there was a constancy. So if you know, if you went to every night of a Billy Graham crusade, you would hear Bev Shea sing "How Great Thou Art," and at the end, the mass choir would sing "Just As I Am," and you had a chance to come forward and change your life. You ask great questions, and I think that there are dozens of reasons that all came together to explain the Billy Graham phenomenon. Time and place. He came along after World War II when American Christendom was looking for hope, was rebuilding their lives after the war, and here came this big, powerful, tall, charismatic figure to say that your life would be changed for the better and all you have to do is come out of your seat and accept Christ.
It's kind of like the John Wayne of religion. When you think about his physical type and his attractiveness behind
him
on television.
And the early coverage of him, there was one description of him as Gabriel and Gabardine and the Barrymore of the Bible. So his physical appearance, I think he was offered a movie contract.
Absolutely.
But he resisted that, you know, worldly temptation.
Because he ended up preaching to more than 210 million people in 185 countries and territories, including tent revival meetings behind the godless Iron Curtain, where, you know, religion was forbidden. How did he do that? How did he get back
there? I think North Korea is still his largest single crowd of a million people.
Why did they let him in? I mean, they closed churches and condemned religion. Why did they let him in?
He was just this accessible. First of all, he knew how to work countries and leaders and world leaders, and we can talk about the presidents and the power that he was drawn to and that were drawn to him. So he had this massive, really clever organization behind him that could take him places other people could not go. And he came along at times when countries were either looking to open up or there was a political reason why that country's leader would allow him in. And he would just always figure out, be on the threshold of the change that would take him to new places.
So would that make him, would it be wrong to say that he was probably the second most influential religious leader of the times behind the Pope?
You know, when I was at the paper, I would always use the phrase modern Christendom's most famous figure, because there was Jesus and there were, you know, the disciples. So, but modern Christendom, but then we talk about Mother Teresa and we talk about the Pope would be the other ones in the same sort of on one hand that you could count them. So, you know, it depends how you want to use that phrase.
At this recent meeting, the authors, the co-authors and co-editors of this this volume, someone was thinking out loud about the Mount Rushmore of Christendom, and I think it would be Graham and Martin Luther King Jr.
Right.
and John Paul II. And the question is, you know, who would be that fourth person? But Graham is up there. I'm not sure if I would put him. You'd have to have King up there, and you'd have to have John Paul II up there.
Okay. There was nobody else in the world of television ministry or evangelical ministries that was on his level.
No.
Because of his influence with leaders and also just his success as a preacher.
Right. And I think leaders felt free to approach him. This kind of goes on with what Ken was just saying. They felt free to approach him because he was unimpeachably, he had this integrity.
Which we will talk about. Dr. Ann Blue Wills, Associate Professor of Religion, writing a book on Ruth Bell Graham, Billy Graham's wife, and Ken Garfield, author of Billy Graham, A Life in Pictures. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3. Mornings and evenings, the WBTV First Alert Traffic Team provides traffic updates and alternate routes. Also, on mobile app and at WBTV.com.
And by Northeastern University Charlotte, a strong tie to the Charlotte community and the world beyond with 3,000 corporate partners, programs in energy systems, engineering, and project management, education, and more. Northeastern.edu/enroll. The day after the election, tomorrow, we look at the outcome and what it may mean, and then move on to a conversation with a man who has been described as the world's most successful choreographer, Matthew Bourne. has brought his game-changing production of Sleeping Beauty to America and to the Belk, and we talk about his approach to breathing new life into many different classics through dance, and about the Blumenthal's involvement in those efforts. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. fracking boom has made the nation the number one energy producer in the world. For this month's Environmental Outlook, what a shifting world energy picture could mean for geopolitics, energy independence, and the environment.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Billy Graham, who celebrates his 95th birthday on Thursday. Ken Garfield is here, longtime religion writer for the Charlotte Observer. He's put together Billy Graham, A Life in Pictures, a new book, which he'll be talking about on November the 10th at the Levine Museum of the New South. Also, Dr. Ann Wills with us, associate professor of religion, who's writing a book about Ruth Bell Graham and collaborating with several other authors and scholars on a book about Billy Graham. And we were talking just before the break about his remarkable influence over the time that he broke into public consciousness through the pretty much end of his career, because he's not feeling well these days at 95 and retired several years ago, made his last altar call or sermon.
Big crusade, mass crusade.
But there's a photograph in your book that you say is your favorite photograph, and it caught my eye when I was leafing through the book, because it shows you where he is in the pantheon of stardom of the 20th century.
Especially in the Carolinas, the old Charlotte Coliseum marquee on Independence Boulevard, and coming attractions were Billy Graham, wrestling, and Elvis Presley. Everything you'd need in life.
Was there a wrestler named Billy Graham? Because there's a young person that you reference that is in college today and thought he was a wrestler.
Grant Wacker, who's writing a scholarly book on Graham, said he spoke to a Connecticut college and asked if they knew who Billy Graham was, and a kid raised his hand and said, oh, yes, that's the professional wrestler. Being the student of professional wrestling that I am, there was a wrestler named Billy Graham, not the same as the evangelist.
And then there was an organization in San Francisco called Bill Graham Presents, and that was – they did rock and roll concerts.
Correct. The Fillmore East, where I have been.
Exactly right. Now, he came to religion as a lanky farm boy who really had no real serious calling until he went to this tent revival meeting and came forward and accepted Christ. Ruth Bell Graham, on the other hand, was raised by missionary parents,
right,
and intended to become a missionary herself, a Tibetan missionary. She was religious. So what happened to change that path in her life?
Billy happened to change that path, and he worked really hard to convince her that God was leading her to him and to be a partner in his ministry rather than leading her to the mission.
Because to be at that time, to be a partner in mm-hmm. your husband's ministry was to be in the background,
mm-hmm.
to be supportive.
Right. It's amazing how consistent that role has been, again, through the centuries of American Christianity, American Protestantism, that the clergy wife's role was really as a support role.
You say that when he first laid eyes on mm-hmm. her, he fell in love. Right.
That's what he says, right.
What was her reaction to him when she first met him?
She claims not to remember when they first met. I'm sure she took some pleasure in telling that. But she does remember their first date and their courtship, of course, and she wrote poetry about her feelings for him. She even wrote before they met. She wrote even though she had decided that she was going to be a missionary in Tibet, which was the tiniest and most arduous mission field she could have selected for herself. There was a mission there, but it was really, really tiny. She wanted to be with the Tibetan nomads, no less.
She came from the Presbyterian Church.
She came from the Southern Presbyterian Church. Her parents were both in the mission field in China.
Okay.
Father was a physician. Mother was a nurse. Very devoted to the Southern Church.
Mm-hmm.
But she had made a list of the qualities she would look for in a man, and you know, you could kind of line those up with what she saw in Billy.
How difficult was it for her to give up her ambitions?
That's a really good question. I think their courtship, as any courtship really, was complicated. And one of the main questions that she had, she was just really seriously devoted Christian all of her life and always had prayed. I mean, she even prayed for martyrdom, and her sister, her older sister Rosa, would come in and kind of pray after Ruth and say,
sure,
Lord, she doesn't. No, they were good. They were Presbyterian through and through. They were serious Presbyterians. And she remained a lifelong Presbyterian. He became a Baptist. Billy became a Southern Baptist.
So how did that work out? There are differences between Presbyterians
right,
and Southern
right.
Baptists.
Right. She, at one point early in their relationship, Billy questioned how Dr. Bell, Ruth's father, could be a real Christian and be a Presbyterian. And that was one of the most serious arguments they ever had. But they were, she was committed to the Reformed vision of theology, and that's, she said, I'm not changing. This is who I am. And the fact that they ended up at Montreat kind of reinforces that
so
conviction.
Did she agree with his preaching?
Oh, definitely, yeah. And especially early on in their marriage, he took a pastorate, and then early still, he was made president of a seminary, a Bible school, and she was there constantly saying, you did not say you wanted to be a local pastor. That's not what you are called to be. You're not called to be the president of a Bible school. You're called to be an evangelist, and that's what I am here to help you do, is evangelism, not local pastoring.
Is that why you say that he would not have achieved the success that he did without her support?
That's one reason.
Because she pushed him.
She did.
Take the path he'd already chosen.
She pushed him. She tempered him. She gave him some gravity. When he was tempted to run off in all these directions, one of the things that we have come upon again and again and again is his kind of eagerness and openness and willingness. If someone asked him to do something, yeah, sure, I'll do that. Ruth was always there with an awareness of limited time, limited resources, limited energy to just kind of bring things back down.
I also think, you know, she stayed home with the five kids,
yeah.
And you know that's a role you can't say too much about. And I've heard Graham talk over the years about the regret of being gone for months at a time while she was home with the children. And so you can't forget that. The other part of this is I think everybody's life and ministry is a story in a way. And I think part of the Billy Graham story is this beautiful love affair that he had with this beautiful, talented poet missionary's daughter. And that people were drawn to that story, and they saw themselves in that story, and they wished they could be like that. And I think that's a powerful part of, you know, the question we ask every day, which is, why did he touch so many lives for so long?
I was reading through notes that you had for a talk that you gave, Ann, and is it true that Billy Graham once told Ruth, "I have never taken your advice, and I don't intend to begin now." And her retort was, "I'd be ashamed to admit that I had married a woman whose advice I couldn't take."
That's at least how Patricia Cornwell puts it in her book. And she had access to papers and diaries.
She was very close to the family.
Right, yeah. Exactly, and had access to Ruth's papers, which I haven't had access to. But, yeah, that is an example of the kind of gravity that Ruth could exert on the relationship. If two people agree in a marriage, one of them is unnecessary. That's another one of her.
Her famous shtick was that people would ask her about their marriage, and she said, "Well, I never thought about divorce, but I thought about murder several times."
I think she says that on Phil Donahue's show,
yeah.
And it gets a great response.
Unlike other evangelists, and we've talked a little bit, we've scratched the surface on this, Billy Graham had no scandals that I know about attached to his lifelong ministry.
Correct.
How was he able to do that? I mean, when so many others fail?
Complicated answer. He's a man of integrity. I think you start there. I think you surround yourself, as he did, with men of integrity, and men that have been with him for a half a century or more that had his very, very best interests at heart. Building a ministry that set personal and financial rules. For instance, the famous Modesto Manifesto in Modesto, California, long ago, they decided Billy would never be alone with another woman in a hotel room or anywhere.
That any of them would be alone with a woman except for their wife.
Correct.
And this was really early. This was amazing kind of preternatural awareness of what could go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So the management of their own images and their own behavior and the management of the money. They
Correct.
Really did not want to look like anything shady financially was going on. So he took a salary, and this, I think, too, was part of the,
right.
the manifesto.
Right.
Yeah, he never lived extravagantly, did he?
No, lives in a log home in Montreat, yeah. an old missionary town.
So since this worked so well for Billy Graham, both in terms of building a good life and also in terms of achieving what he wanted to achieve with his ministry, why didn't that become the template for other people who followed behind him?
Oh, that's a great preacher's question. You know, my answer to that is fame, fortune, greed, sin. Why did Jim Baker fail? Did he have the integrity and the intelligence and the intellect to all those things are needed to avoid the scandal that befell him?
You know, does it take intellect when you look at the template that Billy Graham laid down, and all you have to do is follow it, do your own manifesto, do this, do that, and you're on your way.
I think fame and fortune and
influence, the potential for influence too is maybe too
yeah.
tempting for people to resist.
And you know, you're preaching God's word, and how powerful is that? That you think that you can translate and interpret God for people, and the power you must feel. I mentioned early on the lessons that Billy Graham offers the rest of us, even in the local church. Here in Charlotte, in the faith community, we're having a very healthy debate about a prominent pastor who has built a 16,000-square-foot house.
Stephen Furtick
at Elevation Church. When I saw that, I said, oh, that's the Billy Graham story all over again, and how Billy Graham avoided that. Now, why didn't Billy Graham ever build a 16,000-square-foot house? He probably didn't in his heart want one or need one. He had people that told him, you don't want to do that. You need to be accountable for the money and for your lifestyle. Lots of reasons why he didn't. But those are the lessons that for the local church in this town and every town.
Television gets involved with things, and when TV gets involved in things, TV tends to take ownership of things and also make them incredibly successful, if they're successful at all, on TV. Look at the NFL. Television made the NFL. Television, arguably, I think, made Billy Graham. Legend has it, since I used to work there, that it was because of Charles Crutchfield, who ran WBT and WBTV for years, that Billy Graham first got on television. Is that true? Do you know?
I have not heard that story. Would not be surprised. Billy's roots in Charlotte ran deep as far as with the movers and the shakers. You are right to say that he figured out how to harness television and every other platform of communication unlike anybody else. And he'd have a crusade, and they'd tape it, and 2 months later you'd watch it on WBT at 8 o'clock on a Friday night, kind of the highlight synopsis of the crusade. Whether Charles Crutchfield and the machine that was WBT was involved, that sounds very plausible.
Was he the first person to have the kind of success and influence because of television? Was he the first person to do that? I know there were people on radio before him, but what about TV?
No, I think so. I think he would have been the first to really figure out not just the that television was the next thing, but how to make it work and how to look into the camera in a way that was compelling to who was watching.
Is that something that he had to learn, or was it intuitive for him?
Because
he had the looks and the charisma and the presence.
I think that's another topic that the co-authors in this project have discussed a lot. You know, how much of this is just native genius and how much of it is manipulation? And I think there's a combination.
Because he has been described as slick and savvy.
Right.
And
right.
there's nothing wrong with that, I suppose, but I mean,
right.
that there are negative connotations
right.
to those
then,
two words.
Therefore, it's not genuine.
Yeah.
And I think what makes him different is, yes, he's slick. I have a little bit more problem with slick than I do with savvy. Savvy, I'll give
mm-hmm.
you.
Yeah.
But there's also at the end of the day, it was him communicating that gospel message.
Was he
anything that could power that was okay?
Was he the inventor of modern day religious crusades, or just the most successful at it?
I would say, just the most successful at it, that he mastered, he and his machine mastered this blend of spectacle, entertainment, communication, television, photogenic personality at the heart of it all. There were tent revivals and crusades and traveling evangelists throughout history before, during, and after Graham. And I think now you can turn on television now and going back to the Bakers here in Charlotte and just look at the production value and the integrity value of a Billy Graham crusade versus a Jim and Tammy versus, say, a Joel Osteen or a Pat Robertson, and look at the production value and just the general integrity. And I think Billy Graham always comes out ahead on all counts.
Production values hold up? Because there were old-fashioned production values back then compared to today.
It held up in the sense that you were watching, you know, a variety show. You would you would see the local entertainer, or Johnny Cash, or the local football star share a little bit of testimony. You'd have a mass choir. You'd have George Beverly Shea, who was a wonderful gospel singer. You had Billy Graham, who had this charisma and this preaching style.
Talk about the sermons. Talk about the style. What were the sermons like? How were they different from his fellow evangelicals?
Well, one of the things that he would do, and this is really, I wanted to pick up on something you said before, Graham embodied only the most recent kind of flowering of this tent meeting style of going out to the people, going out where the people were to preach, and meeting them where they were. And this was a revolutionary thing, you know, in the early 1700s, but there has been an upwelling of this kind of movement every generation in the United States. It's just kind of something that we do. And he's the latest iteration of it. But I think you can look
at the latest at that time.
The latest of, the 20th century kind of embodiment of this tradition of American evangelicalism. But the question that you asked about...
What were his sermons like? He wasn't fire and brimstone.
He started out pretty fiery and pretty full of brimstone. And especially when you see the early broadcasts, he's looking right at you and he is just going like a machine gun. And Ruth also early on was not a huge fan of his style. He was very embodied and he would move around a lot and wave his arms, and he was notorious for his garish wardrobe.
He was a hot person in a cool medium. And that doesn't work well. So I'm serious. I mean, the television is a cool medium. It doesn't take to hot, to heat.
Well, and he did. He kind of learned that, and he toned things down over the years. And, of course, now if you look at a crusade film from the 70s or the 80s, you can hardly believe that it's the same person.
Is that because he's older and because he's more influential?
I think it's because he's older. There's more of a kind of stateliness to him. But I think also he realized that maybe that was distracting from the message, and for him, really, just relentlessly, it's about the message of God's love and God's salvation, and you know, that's the center of the sermon. The other thing that I would say about the sermons is, and Ruth had a big part in this, he would illustrate his point with stuff from the newspaper, and he would read the newspaper. He would read the local newspaper for months ahead of the city that he was going to, and he would plow that material into the sermons he'd preach.
You call those relatables in broadcast?
Oh, gosh.
We're going to come back, talk more about the message and more about his influence with presidents and other and policy when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at MrRogersWindows.com. And Charlotte Magazine, now celebrating its 45th anniversary. Subscriptions to Charlotte City Magazine are available online at CharlotteMagazine.com. The U.S. fracking boom, something we talked about last week, I believe, has made this nation the number one energy producer in the world. For this month's Environmental Outlook, Diane Ream and her guests talk about what a shifting world energy picture could mean for geopolitics, energy independence, and the environment. And that's all coming in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Ream Show. On Thursday, Kathy Reichs gets played back. We record her tomorrow night here at Spirit Square at McLowan for our 15th anniversary. Hope you can be here or listen on Thursday. We're coming right back.
Arts and cultural groups in Charlotte depend on community support, but convincing the public to contribute financially is often an uphill battle.
It's not that we don't think the arts is important. We do think it's important, but I think all these other things are more in your face.
Join WFAE for a public conversation to explore how the Charlotte area's cultural organizations hope to build a stronger future. Tuesday evening, November 12th at Spirit Square. Details and RSVP at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, sitting in our Spirit Square studio with Ken Garfield, author of a new book called Billy Graham, A Life in Pictures, which is exactly that. He's the former religion writer for the Charlotte Observer. Dr. Ann Wills is an associate professor of religion at Davidson College, writing a book on Ruth Bell Graham and also contributing to a scholarly treatise on the life of Billy Graham. According to one religious scholar at Seattle Pacific University, Graham had a simple message. It was, accept Jesus and know a new life now and forever. Pretty simple. He aimed for the heart, not for the head. And one of you points out that it is estimated that 4% of his crusade audiences over the years answered the altar call and committed or recommitted their lives to Christ. 4% does not, when you consider he preached to millions of people, 4% does not sound like an extraordinarily high success rate. Put that number into perspective.
Oh, you cynical radio host. The Graham people were legendary with numbers. They were like scientific throughout, and that's where that number comes from. You know, I'd be at a crusade, and I'd look at the people, and you think most of them are churchgoers. Most of them have committed their lives to Christ in whatever that means. Mm-hmm. So I think that a lot of it's a reaffirmation. I think it's people kind of strengthening their faith in Christ. Seems like a high number to me. How many went home who didn't get out of the seats and come down onto the stadium floor that were also affirmed, inspired, motivated,
or did it
reminded?
Later.
Right. Yeah.
But it sank in for a while and then
yeah,
did it
come
later.
Back. Okay. And a hallmark of his crusade, which is different than others, his goal was to inspire you back into the local church. You'd answer the call and you'd pray with someone on the floor and they'd give you a tract about Billy Graham. But his whole goal was to get you into the local church and live out your faith every day.
Now, for those people who don't remember Billy Graham or don't know very much about Billy Graham, let's put him in another context, and that is contemporary culture of the time. Mm. It would be highly unusual today for a preacher to appear on David Letterman or on Jimmy Fallon, but he was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson on more than one occasion. Why would Carson want a religious leader on his program, The Tonight Show? He was the king of late-night television. Why would he want a preacher?
Celebrity. You know, it's hard for people today, the younger people especially, to understand his celebrity-ness, both as pastor to presidents, as Bob Hope's buddy. He was just a celebrity. He was a national figure that rose above Christendom, but rose above mass evangelism to be this sort of face of the new American religion evangelism. He was pithy. He was handsome. Best thing to do is to look at the video on YouTube, Woody Allen interviewing Billy Graham. It's classic.
Yeah.
And it's on YouTube, and it gets a zillion
Woody
hits.
Allen interviewing Billy Graham?
Yeah, Woody Allen had a TV show way back when.
And what's that like?
Brilliant. It's
surreal.
Brilliant. It gives you a real sense of Graham's ability to talk to anybody, to be witty, to be relaxed and charming. I would say Johnny Carson would want him on because he was a good guest. He would talk about golf. He would talk about, you know, his handicap. He was just a normal person. And I think, you know, they both used each other. Johnny Carson is inviting this incredibly popular person onto his show, and Billy Graham gets to be there to, you know, share his message.
They're exposing each other to new audiences.
That's right. And something that Ken hasn't mentioned, but, you know, he showed up on the Gallup poll in the top three for decades.
Let's talk about his influence on presidents. The very first picture, the very first photograph, well, it's not even a picture, but it's a picture in your book. It's a collage of Billy Graham with President Reagan, President Clinton, John Kennedy, George W. Bush, Eisenhower, and Obama. He also met with Truman. I'm sure he met with every president between Truman.
He goes back to Truman on up.
Why did he have such sway with such entree to these presidents, and some more than others?
Yes, some more than others. I think he was especially close personally with both Bushes. Second Bush talks about forsaking alcohol after a walk on the beach in Kennebunkport with Graham. I think he became somewhat of a deeply personal friend to the Bushes, less so with Carter. Clinton talks about attending an Arkansas revival of Graham as a kid and coming to faith. So he's closer to some than others. Certainly the Bushes, Obama, he didn't have a whole lot to
do with. Was it mandatory for presidents to engage with Billy Graham?
I think it had that obligatory feel to it, like Ann talks about, is he brought acceptance to these presidents. Obviously, it was political.
Did he nudge them on policy?
No. And that's one of the places where Ruth was lending some weight, some pullback to the whole scheme, because there's a story, famous story that gets repeated about them having dinner with Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Johnson asks Billy Graham, I think, for advice on who he should ask to be his running mate, mm-hmm. and Ruth kicks him under the table and, you know, gives him the don't say anything, this is not your place.
Yeah.
And, of course, LBJ then asks Billy again when Ruth's not in the room, but whenever things started to go specifically political, Ruth would always caution him to pull back.
Where was she during the Richard Nixon era? Because I know that he called Richard Nixon after a speech from the Oval Office during the Watergate hearing, where Richard Nixon essentially said, I am not a crook.
Right.
And in fact, he turned out to be a crook. And in fact, Billy Graham later said, I got too close and I made a mistake.
Yeah. I think that is clearly historically his biggest regret will be getting too close to presidents in power without speaking truth to power. He wasn't really so much a conscience as he was a supporter, and
right.
you can use even a stronger word if you're a critic of this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's Graham's biggest public historical regret. And then you can bring that up to modern times and have a really good conversation about his son Franklin Graham's political conservatism.
Which I want to do. But before we do that, I want to go back, because when we talked about the Mount Rushmore of American how would you phrase
religion,
it? American religion. You put him up on Mount Rushmore along with Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. And I have two emails about this.
Oh,
one,
good.
One
oh,
from Tony on Facebook and Holly on an email, who want to know where he stood. Where was he on the civil rights movement? Christ did more than evangelize. He was an advocate and activist for those downtrodden, even against the establishment. That's
right.
From Tony. And Holly says, I've read that Billy Graham used his influence with U.S. presidents to defeat civil rights legislation. He did not support racial equality for all Americans. I don't think that would be considered very ethical. What was the real story here?
Right. Well, this is one thing that Grant Wacker is working on, and I wish he were here. He could do this a lot better than I can. But this is a question. Where was Graham on the civil rights movement? He did insist, I think early on, this was before Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, he insisted that the seating be integrated at Memphis Crusade? I think this was 1953. And
very early and very
always insisted that the seating be integrated. Now, we can look at that now and say, you know, big deal. But
it was a big deal.
This was the early 50s when he, you know, had just kind of hit it big and really could not afford to alienate the white business folk in the cities, especially southern cities that he was trying to travel
to. But did he converse with, support the Southern Christian Leadership Conference?
No, I don't think SCLC would have been something that he would have put his weight behind. He did invite Martin Luther King Jr. to be on the rostrum.
Right.
And I can't remember which crusade that was at, but he was invited to be there.
King accept?
Yeah.
Yeah, they had a relationship and a friendship. I would say the consensus was that he was a supporter of civil rights. I don't think he was a leader in civil rights.
Right.
I don't think he was first to that movement.
Right.
But I think that that he came to that movement and endorsed it and embraced it beyond that. But he was not a leader in that movement.
One of the things that William Martin, who has written a really good biography of Billy Graham, says is something like, you know, Billy was never leading the parade, but he was – right. you know, right in the march. So I think on civil rights, this is just this is the way we have to assess Graham, that he was not a Martin Luther King Jr. kind of civil rights activist, but he in one of our authors, Darren Dochuk, is writing about his work in Houston, where he was trying to get the white business leaders and the black entrepreneurs together, and that was his way of opening up lines of communication between the black community and the white community.
Does his influence and his association with presidents and other world leaders say more about him, or does it say more about where America was during his time of prominence?
That's a great question.
I think both. I think one thing about Graham that I've learned over the years is that he was starstruck. He was a Southern farm kid who grew up to be what he became, and he loved rubbing shoulders. He loved dropping names, whether it was Bob Hope or Roy Rogers or Johnny Cash or Richard Nixon. I think that speaks to part of it. I think he wanted to be the pastor to the rich and the powerful and the famous. Did he hold them accountable? Did he push them in the right directions? I would say no. His legacy would say no. Mm-hmm. So I think it's partly America. You know, America has room, at least back then, for a sort of American religious figure.
If he were younger today, would he still be wielding the kind of influence? Would he still have the kind of prominence that he had in the 50s and 60s? And 70s.
That's really fun to think about. And I think so. I was just looking at the My Hope America materials and, again, just the savvy of building a conversation around his speech that's going to be broadcast on Thursday. Bring your family together. Bring your friends together. Do you know people who don't know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior? Bring them together somewhere comfortable. Take them home with you or go have coffee and make sure you can, you know, tune in to this talk. I just think it's really smart. So it would be fun to imagine what he would do with social media and how he would, you know, okay, we won't have a giant crusade. People go to giant, you know, spectacles all the time now. What is a way to bring people to this message?
Well, Billy Graham's publisher, Thomas Nelson, recently released Graham's 32nd book, The Reason for My Hope, Salvation. He still does a daily newspaper column, which oddly appears on the comics page of the Charlotte Observer. Given his health and physical condition, who's really writing these things?
Oh, I think it's clearly a collaboration. Graham cannot see very well, cannot hear very well, and he's got Parkinson's disease, so he cannot write very well. I suspect that he dictates quite a bit. He wrote me a lovely letter, and mm-hmm. it was clearly dictated, and his signature was very, very scratchy. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I think it's dictation. I think the thoughts and the themes are probably his, but there's clearly a collaboration.
Franklin, now his son, Franklin Graham, now runs the Billy Graham Evangelical Association. He appears to be, and obviously I think he is, far more political, at least outwardly political, than his father. He may hold the same views. I don't know. But does he? Do you know?
Oh, I think he's clearly politically partisan to the right of what the Graham Association has been. I think he's changing the brand of the BGEA in a very profound way. I'm not going to say that's right or wrong, but he's changing
his
the brand.
His father's admission that he got too close to power and did not speak truth to power, and the Ruth Graham Graham's push on Billy to stay out of politics. How do you explain this drift into politics by Franklin Graham, and what will it do to the Billy Graham Evangelical Association over time?
I think the second question is completely unanswered. I think we'll know in 20 years. I think when this generation of Billy Graham givers, financial givers and supporters is no longer here, mm-hmm. whether the next generation will support a Sean Hannity, Sarah Palin kind of a guy, that chapter has yet to be written.
Because you said that the more Franklin goes on Fox News and the more he takes stands on homosexuality and his views about Islam, he is changing the way people are looking at the ministry that has his father's name. What's
Absolutely.
His father's take on this? I mean, this is his legacy. What's his father's take on this? Does anybody know?
This is a painful chapter for those of us around the Graham story to write and to figure out. It's, you know, Billy's publicly supportive. He's never said one word in disagreement that I know of to Franklin and the direction that the ministry's gone. Billy lent his name to some on the marriage amendment in North Carolina on the conservative side of that. So publicly, there's been no rift whatsoever. privately, who knows?
Franklin denies accusations that he orchestrated newspaper ads ahead of the last presidential election that featured his father urging voters to choose candidates with biblical values and which appeared to endorse Mitt Romney without naming him.
Right.
So if not Franklin, who put words in his father's mouth? Or did Billy Graham do that?
It's a collaboration, I think. Billy is still the chairman of the BGEA. That's Franklin still works with him and consults with him. It's a collaboration. Franklin is running the day-to-day operation. It's not a coincidence that this big Thursday celebration of his birthday and this My Hope ministry that Ann talked about is going to be on a Sean Hannity-hosted show on Fox News. That immediately brands that whole show and that whole ministry in a way that's very profoundly different than it had been branded under Billy. It's a collaboration with Franklin in charge.
Hmm. I know you have pictures of yourself with Billy Graham in your book, and you have pictures of yourself with Franklin Graham in your book. What's your relationship with Franklin, given some of the things that you have said about how he's running things, how he's running the show?
I've go back writing about Franklin in almost 15, 20 years. I've always found him accessible. He will do interviews. He will speak up for himself. He will defend himself. He's been forthcoming. He's been friendly and warm. He wrote me a nice note about this book. Politically, he is what he is. And I kind of respect the fact that here's what I believe. Here's where I'm taking this ministry. Here's what I do. And I'll be man enough to stand up for it.
What do the two of you think his legacy, Billy Graham's legacy, will be?
Wow. I think we will be asking that question for a long time. That's part of what the legacy is, trying to figure out where evangelical Christianity fits into the public square is part of his legacy.
I think it's the millions of lives that he touched in a very profound, simple way and offered hope to Catholics, Christians of all colors.
Ken Garfield is the author of a brand new book called Billy Graham, A Life in Pictures. It has words in it, but there are a heck of a lot of pictures. And he's the former religion writer for the Charlotte Observer. And Dr. Ann Wills is an associate professor of religion at Davidson College, writing a book on Ruth Bell Graham and also on Billy Graham with other authors. Thank you for the hour.